Back to Estonia. When Joseph Stalin died in 1953, many of his devoted supporters were grief-stricken. At the time, Ella Tolm was in a prison cell with six other sisters. The guard came in crying and ordered them to stand up and salute Stalin. They courageously refused. As a result of Stalin's death, the political atmosphere began to change. From 1956 to 1957, hundreds of petitions on behalf of the exiled brothers were sent from the Worldwide Brotherhood of Jehovah's Witnesses to the Soviet government. One by one, exiled witnesses were granted amnesty. Those in prison were released, and those in exile were allowed to move back home. Some witnesses were released soon after Stalin's death, but others had to wait for some time. For example, the Twiman family was exiled in 1951, but was only permitted to return in 1965. And although our brothers were able to return to Estonia, they still had to find a place to live, for all their property had been confiscated when they were sent into exile. Looking back, how did the intimidation, cruelty, hard labor, and appalling prison conditions affect the witnesses? The great majority remained spiritually strong and faithful, even in the face of death. At least 27 Estonian witnesses died in prison or in exile, including Artur Indus, who had served on the service committee in Estonia before being deported. Friedrich Altpaer died soon after his release, evidently from the consequences of hard labor. Jehovah's servants had been subjected to severe tests of faith in Siberia, but they had learned many lessons, and their integrity remained unbroken. Indeed, they emerged from the onslaught with stronger faith and greater endurance. The responsible brothers were all in prison camps, explains Viljard Kaarna, and we remained in contact with them. As a result, in Siberia we always had literature and did well spiritually. Back in Estonia, it was much more difficult to get a regular supply of spiritual food. We don't think we would have done as well spiritually if we had remained in Estonia. Many non-witnesses in exile became bitter as a result of what they suffered. Jehovah's Witnesses, on the other hand, viewed their exile as a spiritually strengthening experience. We learned obedience from the things we suffered, says Corinna Enica. We put our hope in Jehovah and never regretted it. We saw how little we needed to have to survive. My sister Anna and I had only a small suitcase and a box under the bed. Now, if we ever feel we need something more, we reflect on that experience. The best years of our youth, ages 17 to 23, were spent in Siberia. I have often wondered if we would have been as spiritually strong if we hadn't been in exile. I feel that Siberia was the best place for us at the time. Those 5 years in Siberia were soon forgotten, explains another sister. It was as if I had merely been watching a movie for a couple of hours. I know Aitma reminisces, I will never forget the merry dance of the northern lights. Frosty days when the colorful clouds of condensation rose from the sea or rivers, polar days when the sun did not set for 2 weeks, and polar nights when the sunrise was not visible for 2 weeks. I recall the green strawberries that ripened during the short summer, and the Arctic wildfowl that fed off the tiny branches of the slender trees. Despite all the hardships, I felt as though I were on tour in Siberia. I realized that even there, with Jehovah, it is possible to be happy. New times, old tactics. After the brothers returned to Estonia from Siberia, the persecution did not end. The secret police used both direct and indirect tactics to get information about the organization and slander it. Yuri Schoenberg, who had been arrested for refusing to do military service, was taken from the labor camp for intensive interrogation. A special KGB agent had traveled from Kiev, Ukraine, to Estonia to persuade Yuri to work for the KGB. The officer tried to show him that the literature of Jehovah's Witnesses was anti-government and full of mistakes. He gave Yuri some copies of The Watchtower to read, but although the magazines appeared to be genuine, Yuri refused to accept them. He was afraid that they might be some of the counterfeit watchtowers that the KGB sometimes prepared to cause confusion among the witnesses. For an entire week, the agent pressured Yuri from morning until evening to collaborate with the KGB, but our brother remained steadfast and refused to compromise. The following is from page 213 of the printed edition. Objects of slander. Happy are you, Jesus told his disciples, when people reproach you and persecute you and lyingly say every sort of wicked thing against you for my sake. Matthew 5:11. True to their master's words, Jehovah's Witnesses are frequently the objects of malicious slander. The Witnesses were falsely accused of being a political organization involved in subversion and espionage. Especially in the late 1950s and the early 1960s, newspapers claimed that our work was led by the U.S. government and that we were exploited by wealthy American capitalists. After refusing to do military service in 1964, Silver Siliksar was accused of being a betrayer of the fatherland and sentenced to prison. Also, a short movie of his trial, laced with pompous communist propaganda, was shown in every movie theater across Estonia. Most brothers who refused to do military service were imprisoned for 2 to 3 years. Yuri Schoenberg, Tavi Kuusk, and Artur Mikit were each imprisoned twice, Brother Mikit for a total of 5.5 years. Returning to the account. Renewed contact with Mother. Even though the Iron Curtain was tightly closed, it could not completely prevent the light of Bible truth from shining through. For years, the brothers had to subsist on literature from previous years. However, while in exile in Siberia, the Estonian Witnesses were able to meet with brothers from other parts of the Soviet Union. Once they were back in Estonia, they bravely maintained these contacts with brothers in the Soviet Union and were able to obtain fresh spiritual food from time to time. For example, starting in 1956, they had contact with Ivan Dzepko and others from Ukraine and were able to obtain literature from them. But those contacts were rare, and the amount of literature was limited. Something more was needed, and soon Jehovah blessed our brothers' bold efforts. Under the direction of the governing body, the Finland branch made plans to help the brothers in Estonia more systematically. Vilho Eloranda, who had worked as a pioneer in Estonia in the 1930s, was assigned to make contact with them. In the early 1960s, on his first trip to Estonia, he managed to contact Fani Heedala. After that, many Finnish brothers, posing as tourists, served as couriers and helped maintain a constant channel of communication. At last, the brothers in Estonia were in contact with Mother, as the brothers called Jehovah's organization. They could send field service reports and correspondence and could receive literature on microfilm. However, because the arrangement had to be carried out in complete secrecy and with the greatest discretion, contact was limited to 2 or 3 times a year. The following is from pages 209 and 210 of the printed edition. A Self-Sacrificing Spirit. Fani Heedala. Born 1900. Baptized 1925. Died 1995. Profile. Moved to Estonia in 1930. Pioneered and adopted a witness orphan. Fani was baptized in Finland in 1925 and entered full-time service 2 years later. At a convention in Helsinki, she met William Day, the overseer of the Northern European office. Although they did not speak the same language, Brother Day kept repeating the word Estonia. Deducing that he was encouraging her to move to a place where the need was greater, Fani, as well as some other pioneers, moved to Estonia in 1930. During the following years, she made good use of her bicycle to preach the good news in several counties across Estonia, including the island of Saaremaa. Fani never got married, but she adopted an orphan girl named Esther, whose mother and witness father had both died by the time she was 8. With Fani's loving care, Esther grew up to embrace the truth. When the communist regime arrived and the persecution started, Fani could have moved back to Finland. However, she demonstrated a self-sacrificing spirit by staying with a small group of local publishers. As a result of her decision to stay, she endured many difficulties and poor living conditions, but because of her Finnish citizenship, she was not exiled to Siberia. Fani served as a courier, carrying microfilms and correspondence from Finland to Estonia during the 1950s. She was known for her courage and discretion, and although there were some very tense situations, she was never caught. For example, once she traveled to Leningrad, St. Petersburg, to pick up a package of microfilms from a Finnish courier brother in a certain park. She, in turn, was to hand the package on to two Estonian brothers as quickly as possible. However, the Estonian brothers had noticed that they were being followed by the secret police and tried to slip away unnoticed by Fani. Alas, Fani and the Finnish brother walked straight in the direction of the Estonian brothers. If she had greeted them or tried to give them the package, the secret police would have uncovered their connection. Amazingly, Fani walked right past them as if she did not know them. Actually, it turned out that she simply did not see them, even though she knew them both very well. As a result, the secret police never found out who the couriers were, and the package was safely handed over afterward. Fani's help as a contact allowed for a steady flow of spiritual food, and thankfully, none of the microfilm shipments were ever discovered. This warm-hearted sister served Jehovah faithfully for 70 years, until her death at the age of 95 while still residing in Estonia. Returning to the account, Adolf Kosei's cousin, Hugo Kosei Jr., who lives in the United States, traveled to Estonia 15 times as a courier. On one of his trips, the border guards searched him thoroughly but found nothing. Things got tense, though, when the guards asked him outright to which religion he belonged. Noticing that the officials did not speak fluent English, Hugo started to chatter away rapidly in English. The officials did not want to betray their ignorance by asking him to speak slowly, so when the phone rang, they told him to hurry along because the ship was ready to sail. Of course, he carried out this instruction without delay. Those who served as couriers knew how important their assignment was, and they took it very seriously. They were always cautious and were constantly aware of the danger of becoming overly confident. Field service reports were encoded in case they ended up in the wrong hands. The couriers realized that they could put their own life and the lives of others in danger by being careless. At times, they saw KGB agents following them. While waiting to receive a package from two brothers, Viljard Kaarna saw an agent photograph and then follow them. No doubt he was gathering evidence to use against the witnesses. Yet, over all those years, the brothers never lost a single shipment of literature or any correspondence or reports. Improved organization. For some time, the preaching work in the Soviet Union had come under the oversight of a country committee based in Ukraine. In addition, several brothers served as district overseers throughout the vast land. But now the growing organization in Estonia called for someone to take oversight of the work locally. Quiet in nature and tempered by various trials of faith, Adolf Kosei was assigned to help organize this work in 1967. Later, responsibility was increased to include processing correspondence and reports for Latvia, Lithuania, Karelia, Leningrad, now St. Petersburg, and Murmansk. Brother Kosei also helped organize the printing work in various locations. How did Brother Kosei manage to care for all those responsibilities and also work full-time with his wife, Koidula, on a pig farm near the town of Tapa? Brother Kosei invented some machinery that made his secular work somewhat easier. This, in turn, allowed him more time to care for his theocratic assignments. Later, brothers such as Villard Kaarna, Lembit Tome, and Silver Siliksar helped with visiting congregations in Estonia and neighboring republics of the Soviet Union. As the Russian field in Estonia grew, Alexander Yevdokimov served in a similar way. In time, the printing work was divided, and the Russian-speaking brothers in Estonia did their own printing. When their publications arrived on microfilm, they were already in Russian and could be duplicated directly onto photographic paper. Eventually, though, as congregations grew, this laborious photo-duplicating method was replaced, as it could not keep pace and required a large number of brothers to help with the printing in several locations. Despite their limited resources, the brothers had printed hundreds of copies of more than 20 different books underground. Over 5 million pages of Estonian and Russian literature were produced by hand between 1966 and 1989. Caution essential. Policemen once searched a brother's home under the pretext of looking for a stolen motorcycle. However, they went straight to a bookshelf, clearly an unlikely place to hide a motorcycle. Obviously, they were really looking for banned literature. How disappointed they were to find none. How did the brothers camouflage the literature and keep it hidden? When they produced the literature, they often bound it with covers from old secular books or journals. Thus, when homes were subjected to unexpected searches, such old publications usually went unnoticed. The witnesses used special occasions, such as weddings, as a cover for meetings and assemblies. For example, Haymar and Elvi Twiman's wedding lasted for 2 days. Sometimes such gatherings lasted 3 or 4 days. The Estonian elders encouraged couples to arrange weddings that were not too large. Smaller groups were not so visible, attracted less attention, and were less likely to cause difficulties. Russian brothers move in. In 1970, longtime witnesses from Ukraine, Belarus, and other parts of the Soviet Union began moving into Estonia. For many of those brothers, life in Estonia was much easier than it was in their native country, where they had endured brutal persecution. With the help of brothers such as Nikolai Dubovinsky, a longtime elder from Ukraine, the first Russian-speaking congregation was formed in Tartu in 1972, with about 50 publishers. The Russian field was fertile, and by 2010 there were 27 Russian-language congregations and 4 Russian-language groups, comprising more than half the publishers in Estonia.